very happy now to welcome to the show award-winning photographer Steve Fitch. His work will be exhibited at the Photo Eye Gallery, and the opening is this Saturday, the 25th of February, from 3 to 6. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So your work, at least a lot of it, I mean, you do all different kinds of work, but a lot of the work that I saw and that will be exhibited at the Photo Eye Gallery is about kind of 1950s and beyond highway culture, hotels, motels, highways, neon. How did you get started on that whole trip?
Good question. You know, I graduated from the University of California, Berkeley, with a degree in anthropology in 1971 and started traveling the highways to make photographs. I had this idea in my mind that I wanted to photograph the quote-unquote American highway. And I think it partly came about from reading On the Road by Jack Kerouac.
I wonder how many artists can say, artists and writers can say that that book changed their life.
A lot.
A lot.
And it did mine, I guess. And, you know, I'd listened to Bob Dylan, and somehow that put some wanderlust into me. I was glad to get out of college. I wanted to work on my own project. And I just had this idea in my mind that I wanted to photograph the highway without really knowing what I meant. And I started taking these trips. I had a Ford Econoline van that I put a photo platform on the roof. And I would take a week or two or three-week trips, come back to Berkeley where I had a job managing a darkroom and teaching photography. And I would develop the pictures, look at the prints. And so this project, Photographing the Highway, evolved over about a five-year period.
Now, when you say photo platform on the roof, you would go stand on the roof of the Econoline van and take pictures?
Right, and try not to fall off because I wanted a higher vantage point. And I usually worked on a tripod. And, you know, at first, all I knew was I wanted to photograph the highway without really knowing what that meant. And I photographed tourists, truck stops, truck drivers. I started noticing a lot of neon signs, funny things like snake pits and dinosaur parks. And the project evolved. At one point, I thought something was missing from what I was doing. So on the next trip, I made some night pictures of some motels, some neon signs, you know, without really even knowing if I could make a nighttime picture. And it turns out when I got back, developed the film, made the prints, I really liked some of the nighttime pictures. So a lot of the highway photographs were made at night. And eventually, the photographs were published in a book called Diesels and Dinosaurs. And what was really interesting to me about this project was I really learned something about the creative process. That, you know, you start with an idea and you do something on that idea, then you engage the feedback loop, you look at what you did, and then you take the next step, make some more pictures. And so it really organically evolved, you know, the project. And that's something when I teach, you know, I try to teach students, you know, the idea has to grow and you have to, you know, engage the feedback.
Right.
Two people really influenced, I think, my photography, and they were professors at University of California, Berkeley. One was a guy who taught in the anthropology department named Alan Dundas, who was a folklorist. And he had a folklore archive at the university, and he was real into collecting oral folklore, jokes, stories. His classes were very popular because he would tell jokes and then analyze them. Well, in a way, I think that influenced me, and that I kind of see my work, you know, starting in 1971 and ever since, as being a kind of collecting of folklore.
Well, and there's a lot of humor in it, too.
Yes, there is.
So you have a new little book called Motel Signs, and in its own way, almost every one of them has kind of a joke in it.
Yeah. And some of the Diesels and Dinosaurs pictures were, I think, pretty funny. There was a picture of a man at a snake pit where he had, you know, pits of rattlesnakes and cobras and all this crazy stuff, and tourists would stop. He was out painting a car hood that he was going to use as a sign, and he was painting this message on there, "We do not have a dinosaur."
Right.
Because he was irritated that people kept stopping, and here he had all these crazy snakes and things, but they wanted to know if he had a dinosaur. So I thought that was great.
Yeah.
I think the picture's kind of funny. And it's classic American sort of practicality, I guess. To paint a sign, he goes and gets a car hood and paints the sign on it.
Right. I think it's cool that you do some of these, that you did some of these as night photographs, because, of course, night is when you pull up into the motel.
Right.
That's sort of when the reality of the motel is happening.
Yeah, and, you know, the book was about the highway and about being on the highway. So much of that experience is really, for me, and I think for a lot of people, has to do with traveling at night.
Yeah.
You know, you're picking up funky AM radio stations. Especially out west, you can see the towns coming sometimes 20 miles away because the motels are lit with neon and there's neon signs. So, yeah, the night was a very important part of that book, and because it was so much a part of the highway experience. And you know, ever since then, I've continued to do quite a few pictures at night. You know, there's a beauty to the light. I got really into long exposures. And, you know, when you're doing a 20-minute exposure, lots of little events can happen. You know, trees yeah. blowing. And it does something visually interesting to the pictures a lot of times.
Tell us more about what happens when you do long exposures as opposed to doing what you might call snapshots or exposures of less than a second. I mean, do the pictures have a different quality embodied in them because of being long exposures?
Well, yeah, I think so. The light is a little different. You know, I think one project I worked on where it's maybe interesting in long exposures was a book photographing the interiors of abandoned buildings on the Great Plains. And this was a project that was published in a book called Gone. You know, for years I'd seen all these buildings that were abandoned when I would cross the plains. And in 1991, I took a trip and actually started going inside some of the houses and schools and got very excited because the interiors were so interesting. There would be houses where people had left, but all their stuff was there. So I started making photographs, and they were a lot like night pictures in that it was dim interiors. So I had to do long exposures, you know, 2 minutes, 8 minutes, 10 minutes, sometimes even 40 minutes. And if you look at the pictures, they're in color. Different events happen. The wind is blowing, so sometimes a door will be blowing open and closed, open and closed.
Yeah.
And visually, you know, it creates a kind of interesting look. And as a personal experience, the photographing it, the long exposures, what I really like about them is, you know, I have to stand there for 15 minutes, 20 minutes as the exposure is going on. And in a way, it's like it's almost like Zen kind of thing. I'm standing inside the exposure. And, you know, I usually can't walk around because I don't want to shake the camera.
Yeah.
So I just stand there. And it kind of stops time for me. And I look around. And, you know, inside these buildings, there was usually a lot of noise because the wind was blowing or there were a lot of birds. So I think, for me, it maybe doesn't all translate into the photographs, but just the experience was great. Stopping time and, you know, it's like going to the dentist or something where you can't do anything for 40 minutes, so your time stops. I kind of like that. And then when you see the photograph, though, it looks like it was an instant. And yet if you know how to read photographs, you can start to detect that this was a longer exposure because you can sort of see things like the fact that the curtains were blowing.
We're talking to photographer Steve Fitch. Those photographs of the ruined and empty abandoned buildings are really intense because, well, for a lot of reasons. First of all, one wonders what the social history is, why all these buildings, houses, classrooms, and so on, public spaces, are completely and totally decayed.
Yeah, and why they were abandoned.
Yeah.
You know, that was, I mean, it was, I learned a lot doing those pictures. They were all made on the high plains of the Great Plains, which was the farthest, you know, west part of the plains. And it was the last part of the Great Plains to get homesteaded. And what happened is not too long after the homesteaders settled, sometimes as late as 1915, they really started abandoning the Great Plains because they couldn't farm the 160 acres or whatever. So it's almost like when, ever since the High Plains started getting settled, they started getting abandoned. And I come along in 1990, 91 and start making these pictures. And, you know, we all know about the Dust Bowl when this abandonment occurred, but it's still going on. And, you know, especially, say, in eastern New Mexico, I would find schools that had been built by the WPA in the 1930s, for example, in a little area between Tucumcari and Clovis. And the school would have 350 students. And then in 1963, it would close, and the final class had seven students.
Yeah.
So, the you know, this is all about this abandonment of a region, a big region. It goes all the way up to North Dakota, eastern Montana. And to me, what was really exciting was to go inside these places and see all the stuff that just got left. You know, you would have ceilings caving in, walls caving in, you know, the building falling apart, and yet a lady's dress might still be hanging in the closet, you know, delicate things.
Right. Or
one of the most, I don't know, poignant thing, photographs or places, was a house in western North Dakota where the abandoned, but dresses, everybody, all the stuff was there, and there was a snapshot, a photograph on the wall of an old couple who must have been the couple living there. And, you know, something sad about that, to leave the place, either they died or they moved, and to leave all their personal stuff, including their snapshots or their family pictures.
Yeah, I mean, looking at those pictures, there's so many responses that one has or that I had, and one of them is how completely people are forgotten over time. Some people who live on in history, but most of us vanish from any kind of memory.
Yep.
And you look at these things, you look at these buildings that are collapsed, that are decayed, that are falling apart, and it's not like they're once splendid grandeur still shines through. They were never grand in the first place.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it was making these pictures, like sometimes, like the one I just described where the family album, family pictures were there, one was hanging on the wall. You know, sometimes I felt sort of like a voyeur that I'm in these spaces that are so tangibly personal. You know, there'd be fingerprints on the refrigerator and dentures in the bathroom and then the family pictures and the bank statements, you know, and I'd feel a little bit guilty maybe, but then on the other hand I felt like I was on a mission and that actually I was paying attention and I was the last person maybe or the only person to ever even really honor these places by making the photograph and paying attention to them. So I felt okay about it, and kind of in relation to what you're saying, most of these places were houses, humble, you know, and people moved on. You know, I used to think of it as a failure, that they failed in those places, which maybe was true to some extent. But on the other hand, some of the people might have moved on to Seattle or to Portland and ended up having a better life.
Yeah.
You know. But I think what really struck me personally, too, is that this was a time when my wife and I were building our own adobe house in New Mexico.
And there's a picture in one
of
the books.
And And we had two young boys, and in a sense, we were homesteading. And here, you know, I'm building a place and creating a life. And meantime, I'm going out on these trips, photographing all these places where people had done the same thing, had the same ideas, same ambition, and it didn't work. And it was an interesting 10 years when I worked on those pictures.
It's humbling, and it takes one's mind into a kind of bigger context than what one's normal life is.
Yep.
The other thing that I was thinking when looking at the motels and the neon and the kind of 1950s based American culture is how, in some ways, particularly out west, how primitive and unsophisticated and simple and even shallow our culture is, that when it's especially represented in those ways, but it's still ours. Like, I identify with those things.
Yeah, well, it's the vernacular in a way.
I mean,
that's a word that I use a lot. It gets applied to my photographs a lot. You know, the popular vernacular of this culture, I find endlessly interesting because of what it says about us. Yes, the motels are a lot of times, you know, pretty low rent, stucco motels. A drive-in movie theater. I've made a lot of pictures of drive-in movie theaters. Very much a vernacular architecture. Sophisticated architects, for the most part, don't design drive-in movie theaters. Some local businessman wants to start a drive-in movie theater, and he maybe hires a friend who is a contractor, and they throw something up.
Right.
But in the process of doing that, you get all these idiosyncratic details. And I like that. Same with neon signs, for example. I got really interested in neon signs and billboards and all kinds of signs. And I think that's why a lot of people find the kind of signage along our highways interesting is that they're very personal and they say something about ordinary people in a way.
There's also, I mean, you started doing this in the 1970s, and I was wondering how, when you look back at them, whether they might look different to you, the same pictures, from different vantage points in your own life.
Oh, yeah, I think so. You know, sometimes people use the word nostalgic about some of my photographs, which I guess can apply. But, you know, when I was making these pictures, there was nothing nostalgic about them. This was the environment. Now, like with the motel signs, the ones I was photographing, and even the drive-in movie theaters, they're gone. The kind of highway that I was photographing was the two-lane highway that was being passed by the interstates. And, you know, I think I had a subconscious sense that the pictures I was making, what I was photographing, it was going to change, and they were going to disappear, like the drive-ins with these big fancy murals on the back.
Even the Yucca Drive-In here in Santa Fe.
Like the Yucca Drive-In. It was like a lot of drive-ins where they put a big mural on the back, a neon mural sometimes, a painted mural that had to do with the history of the area. When I was started making those pictures, you know, there was drive-ins starting to close, but for the most part it was going strong. And the two-lane highway with all these individual mom-and-pop motels and these crazy signs was still going. But as time went on, and in the years since, you know, I've seen all this disappear, basically. You know, the signs, the motel signs in particular, which will be in the show, some of them, were not the franchise signs. It was the pre-franchise. So a couple would open a motel, and they'd have the local sign shop make a motel. And a lot of times there were a lot of skills involved in that, the neon vendor, the sheet metal worker. There'd be some kind of individual design of the sign. You know, everything about it was sort of pre-corporate, pre-franchise.
Yeah.
And so asking me now, looking back on it, I can really see that, I got on to making pictures about America that was really changing, I think. And also looking back on it now, I realize that a lot of my interest in starting to photograph the highway when I graduated from college really had to do with I was, in a way, recreating the experience I had had as a kid traveling with my family, where...
In your Buick.
In our Buick, where we would leave California to go visit our relatives back in South Dakota. And the trip we would take would be a family trip, my sister and I and my parents, in the Buick. You know, we'd stop places all along the way, rock shops and snake pits, and stay in funky motels. And, you know, the trip, the journey back to South Dakota, to the family farm, was as important as actually getting there. And I think that's what the interstates have changed. You know, traveling on the interstates, going on a trip like that, it's like flying in a way. You get on the interstate and you just go 600 miles, get off, the next day you go. You know, the journey has sort of been eliminated. It's more like a joyride or something. So now I look back at a lot of my highway photography, and a lot of it's about a kind of experience that, you know, I think still is there, but less so.
Well, and one of the things I was thinking, you look at some motel sign that seems obsolete or old-fashioned, but then you put yourself in the position of, okay, it's 1948, and they just built this, and suddenly it becomes
a
place of middle-class luxury in a desolate and dry landscape. There's air conditioning. There's running water. There's TV.
Yeah. Well, those signs, like a 1948 sign, it's like a time capsule in a way. You know, I can look at a lot of the signs in my motel signs book, and you almost can date them. This was a late 40s sign or an early 50s. But the signs, though, live through time, too, and they're almost like a ship that accumulates barnacles or something. You'd get new things added on. For example, the signs in the late 1940s or 1950s, they would put the word television in the structure of the sign, letting you know they had a television. Or they'd say air-conditioned or refrigerated air. You know, by the late, well, in the 60s, I guess, you know, you no longer advertised you had a television in your motel because everybody had. You know, they expected that. And it was air conditioning, not refrigerated air.
And now they'll say Wi-Fi.
Now, well, then they'd say HBO or color television. So you'd see a sign that's a 1940 sign, says television, and later you see HBO tacked on or color television, or today, yes, Wi-Fi. And so you'll see some of the signs in my book, and then that'll be in the show, have these kind of layers through time.
And then there's another part, and I don't know how much you focused on this, but again, I was thinking of it when observing your pictures, is in the background, there's always nature. There's always the eternal sky and the grass and the earth.
Yeah, I like the way I make photographs. You know, I'm interested in, you know, making a good photograph and all that stuff. And part of it for me is I want to put the sign in a context. You know, a lot of people photograph this subject matter and they sort of come right up on it and, you know, and edit out the landscape or the surrounding. So in a lot of the pictures, the highway going by, the surrounding buildings, the background is part of the picture, which, like I said, it gives a context, I think.
Steve Fitch is an award-winning photographer, and once again, he is having an exhibition at the Photo Eye Gallery, which is at 376 A Garcia Street. And the opening, which is also a book signing of Steve's many books, is from 3 to 6 in the afternoon on Saturday, February 25th. So that's this coming weekend. For more information, you can go to photoeye.com. Do you have a website?
Yes, I do. SteveFitch.com.
Easy enough, SteveFitch.com. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Russell Baker. He's executive director of the National Dance Institute of New Mexico, NDI New Mexico, and Allegra Lillard. She's the program director of the Dance Barns, which is the after-school program with NDI. Welcome to the Radio Cafe. Thank you.
It's great to be here.
So you've got a very cool program coming up this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. It's called Winter Dance Escape. What's it all about? Who's performing?
Well, the Winter Dance Escape involves our advanced dancers at the Dance Barns. And they are dancers who started with NDI in the public schools in National Dance Institute's program that goes directly into the public schools. They loved it. They graduated onto our advanced programs on the weekends. Then they decided to improve their technique by taking after-school classes. So they are all committed to taking 5 to 6 days after school, rehearsing, performing. So those are the students that are performing next weekend in the Winter Dance Escape. We're very excited. I think it's a great time of year to have a dance concert. It's a little mood lifter in the middle of winter. And it's a very eclectic mix we have going from string trio, a contemporary piece, to another contemporary piece by Curtis Ullman, Barefoot, to The Haunting Sounds of Lila Downs, to a point piece with three ladies, to a very upbeat kind of wacky Broadway song and dance piece by Campbell Martin. So there's surely something in there to please everyone.
So it's a lot of different kinds of dance.
Absolutely. We offer a lot of different options for our students at the Dance Barns. We have ballet, modern, jazz, theater, voice, tap, a lot of different offerings for them in the direction that they want to take their performing arts at this point in their lives.
Now, these are all school-age people who are going to be performing?
Yes, they are. They're mostly high school students. We do have some younger ones as well, a little group called the Junior Company. And they are younger than our advanced dancers, but they're just as motivated and enthusiastic, and they were recommended by their dance teachers at the Dance Barns to be a part of this little group. And they will be also dancing in this Winter Dance Escape. To a piece that I choreographed called With Our Own Two Hands. And it's about making a difference in the world. And they've been just a hoot to work with. We created dance steps based on everyday activities. We call them recycled steps. The lawnmower, for instance, how to start a lawnmower, the sprinkler, spreading the butter, the light bulb. So we had a lot of fun creating that dance. I think, and that's even with the older dancers in the other pieces that we are presenting next week, they've had a lot of opportunity to explore different styles of movement, different ways of approaching the process of creativity, whether it's song or dance, whether it's Broadway, whether it's contemporary dance, whether it's barefoot, whether it's in point shoes. So I think I'm really excited about this because I think it's really giving our dancers and our students the exposure that they need if they have any intention of kind of breaking off and going into the big wide world in the performing arts.
Well, is that what happens? I mean, you've got students of this caliber. Are you then sending them on to academies, conservatories, a professional career, that kind of thing?
Well, it's a really good question. And in fact, we have some students that are doing some great things. We've got two young men that went through the program now performing in ballet companies, one in Ohio and one in Virginia. We have a young man who's in a touring Broadway show, My Fair Lady.
Is that right?
We've got some students that are studying either dance or performing arts of some kind in colleges and universities around the country. But you know, the NDI program is designed not to just train professional dancers. It's really to instill the work ethic and the values that come from a dance class and that come from being in the performing arts. So I think that the neat thing that's happening at the Dance Barns is that we've taken this idea of excellence and how do you become excellent at something, and given kids opportunity to take that to its ultimate level, which in dance is joining a ballet company or being a part of a Broadway production. And that's starting to happen. But, you know, since we started 18 years ago, we estimate that we've worked with 60,000 students in New Mexico with
the
NDI
program. Are you kidding me?
It's incredible. This year alone, we're working with 6,800 students. So we started small. We've grown over the last 18 years. But you can see how that we could get to that number in 18 years. And the thing that's great, another thing that I think that's great about the Dance Barns, kids can start when they're in the fourth grade and stick with us through high school. Or they can even come as tiny tots, 3, 4, 5, 6 year olds. We have programs for kids of all ages.
Including adults. We have adult programs now as well. Ballet, tap, Zumba, yoga, you name it.
Okay. You've got it all going over there on Alto Street.
Yes, Alto Street. In between Agua Fria and Alameda, right off of Camino O'Leary.
Now, we hear so much, and we cover this on my show, and we hear it everywhere, about kids at risk and kids who've got problems and kids who come from poverty and kids who come from drug addict families and all that kind of stuff. Do you have stories, do you have experience of kids from pretty rough situations who find a place in dance? They're both nodding.
Yes, definitely.
Vigorously.
We definitely do. NDI programs are in communities all over New Mexico. We're besides Santa Fe, Albuquerque, and Española, where we have really pretty large programs. We're in 19 other communities, rural Native American pueblos, reservations, from north, south, east, and west. And it's true what you say, that kids in New Mexico are, in a way, standing in the center of a storm, and they're trying to figure out how to deal with a lot of sort of problems, issues that's tough for kids to deal with. The things that you mentioned, drugs and alcohol and family violence, and even just when you look at graduation rates and you look at poverty
illiteracy
rates,
all this stuff.
There are kids that find sort of that they're I like to think of it as like their sails get filled with wind with a program like NDI, dance and music and the chance to perform. And I do think it goes back to those values that we instill during the class that are so integral to the way we teach, which is that working hard, doing your best, not giving up, being healthy, being physically fit, we call those our core four, that those are the things that you can use to be successful in life. Whether you're taking a math test or applying for a job or learning a dance step, it takes effort and energy to be excellent. And that when kids, they have this joyful experience, but B, they build self-confidence in, I can approach something now. And they can find like a haven for themselves. And a lot of kids think of the Dance Barns as a second home, home away from home, because they spend so much time there.
And do they tend to do better in school once they get that stuff going?
Absolutely. All of our students are doing well in school, and if they don't, we generally hear about it and remind them why they need to do better and to carry what they do in our studios over into the rest of their lives. You know, I think both Russell and I are involved with NDI for the same reasons. I mean, there's nothing like witnessing a child discover the power of creativity within themselves. And so many times the students that we work with may not have had that opportunity otherwise, but they have that introduction, and I think it's so wonderful in this day and age, in the crazy world that we live in right now, to supply our youth with these tools of creativity. It's only going to make the world a better place. I can only hope, you know.
Well, and when you think about how important creativity and problem solving are in your adult life, it's not just about test taking. Once you get into the grown-up world, there are no tests that you have to memorize anything for. You actually have to survive through your skill and wit and
working together,
problem solving, and so much of this is what we do in the choreographic process, in the classes that the students take. So many life lessons.
There's also an important point that a friend of mine and I were just talking about this recently. When people talk about how the arts are so important because they help you in all the other areas of your life, I think it's also important to emphasize the arts are an end in themselves.
Absolutely.
And that getting good at or coming to appreciate or coming to find a spiritual center in whatever your art form is, that is a value regardless of whether it helps you do better
regardless
on the math test.
Regardless.
I love going into a public school and working with a group of fourth graders, and instead of calling them students or instead of calling them kids, calling them dancers. And they stand up straighter and they lift their chins and their shoulders go back, and they say, you can see they consider themselves to be dancers, artists.
There's this moment. Did you ever see the Spalding Gray film Swimming to Cambodia? And he talks about being in a film somewhere far away, Australia or something, and the director says, "Now all the artists must come to whatever place." And he was like, "I'm an artist? All right." When you're working with students, particularly you, Allegra, I mean, well, both of you, but working with, again, kids who have never had a discipline before, you must have to walk some line between being tough with them but also being compassionate.
Oh, absolutely. And NDI is all about tough love but a lot of compassion and a lot of understanding. And one of the best experiences I had, and I'm very grateful to Jacques Demboise and this program, I feel like I walked away from, I never walked away, but from the program, but the experience of learning how to teach that technique was so valuable, and it gave me so many tools and understanding. It also taught me to step back and look at the children, and so many times you look at them and it's like looking in a mirror. You're looking at yourself. So I think to become a teacher, you learn as much from the students as they learn from you, and as soon as you realize that, that's when you start to make progress. And they teach me every single day, and yes, it's a very fine line, and yes, that's why you have ballet one and then you have ballet two and ballet three, and they move up, they take those tiny steps, and just being that patience and the nurturing, it'll get them there eventually.
Well, I mean, when we were young, we had the Russian teachers.
Absolutely,
who
with the canes
had whips
and, the,
and yeah,
well,
they did. Didn't. There was no compassion whatsoever.
No, and you know
it
what?
Was
you
just
can't.
Tough.
You can't do that anymore.
I know.
But I think what you say is really true. We think of it as developing rigor in students. That students. You mentioned Jacques Demboise said young people are like little lie detectors. If you say something that's not true, they catch on to it right away. And for us, how that translates into an NDI class is when we say something is well done, when we say it's excellent, that we really finally got to that place.
Yeah.
But until that happens, we keep working and we try to be inspirational, and we try to be humorous, and we try to have fun the whole time. But the ultimate goal is to seriously do your best, to try to reach a level of excellence that everyone can recognize and then celebrate. So I think that's where teachers are tough, but they're loving and tough.
Loving and tough and very patient, because I think you have to be so patient and wait till the very last student in that class has the step before you move on. So how do you do that and make
and
it
not
interesting,
bore everybody else.
Interesting for the one who is a step ahead of everybody else? And that's challenging.
How do you do it?
Oh boy!
Well, there's lots of games that we play. We divide up the classroom into different sort of spatial arrangements. We have kids go by themselves. We do competitions. We take this idea of what would be fun in active, and it just keeps going. So it's sort of like call and response and call and response. So this like energy kind of builds. And I have to say, one of the things that really makes it work is that we have a live pianist in every class. Mm-hmm. And the piano player adds this musical score. It's not just the music to the steps that we're dancing to, but when we stand up or when we sit down or when we move to the right or to the left, there's like it's like a silent movie, and there's this accompaniment that's going along with. If the teacher tells a story, there's a song that goes along with it that the pianist just improvises. So it makes a magical space in a cafeteria or a gym, wherever we're having our classes, that just is like engaging and motivating, keeps everybody going.
And those teaching techniques translate even into a discipline like ballet or jazz. And so we take those techniques learned and taught in a gymnasium or a cafeteria with kids in sneakers, and that can directly translate into a studio in a ballet class or a jazz class with the students in pink tights and leotards and their little ballet slippers. It works.
We're talking to Russell Baker and Allegra Lillard of NDI New Mexico. Let's talk again about the performance that's coming up this weekend called Winter Dance Escape. It's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I noticed you're using... what's that wonderful group called?
Time for three.
They were here. I saw them.
I know.
I got to interview one of them.
I heard
They're
interview.
They're crazy geniuses.
They are. They're amazing. I fell in love with their music immediately.
Was it two violinists and a bass player?
Yes.
Acoustic bass?
I believe so. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Anyway, the piece that I'm doing is Alleluia, and it's a lyrical piece, very contemporary for three couples. I've really encouraged the students to think about the story behind the steps, to be introspective. We talked about the musicality and how to work together as a group. The students in NDI, they get very good at counting music and knowing exactly when to come in on count seven or count five. And so this piece, I took them out of that box a little bit and encouraged them to listen more and to feel one another. So it's been a fun exploration.
That's interesting. So to listen, to basically to get them to cultivate their own musicality.
Absolutely. And move together. And like a flock of birds, you know, moves in the sky when you watch them. It's the same sort of thing that we worked with in this piece of choreography, how to move around the room together, how to lean on one another and support one another without it looking like a step.
Now, you're incorporating American Sign Language into some of the pieces?
Yes. In the junior company piece, With Our Own Two Hands, I asked Megan Goldberg, who works at San Fe School for the Arts and Sciences, to come and work with my dancers in this piece. So we have taken sign language, and it so easily translates to dance. And I was talking to Russell.
It is a kind of dance.
No, it is a dance. And I was telling Russell earlier how amazing it is to watch young people. They absorb it like a sponge. And I had Megan come in and work with them for one rehearsal session, and they picked up on it immediately, whereas I was over there fumbling around with my thumbs and my fingers, and it was so natural for them, and it so easily moved into the dance. And I feel like it's such a wonderful second language experience for young people.
And so they're using it and expanding it out.
Absolutely, into a dance.
Into their whole body. Yes. And so if deaf kids come or people come and
watch it,
they understand what's going on.
Yes, and I've been, I'm bringing her in again, in fact, before next week, just to make sure that we maintain the integrity of the sign, because I feel that's very important, that we're not losing the meaning behind each gesture that they make.
Right. And you're using music by Lila Downs.
Yes, Curtis Ullman created an amazing piece with music from Lila Downs from the Frida soundtrack.
The worst movie ever made, but the music was good.
The music is fantastic, and he's just done a fabulous job with the dancers. As you know, as we know, Curtis, you know, he has this amazing way of manipulating choreography in spatial patterns and working with groups and solos. And I think it's really stretched our dancers and really taking them to another level. I'm really excited for them.
Now, both of you come from hardcore ballet backgrounds, is that right?
Hardcore.
True, true.
Tell us about your own background, Russell.
Okay, well, I came to dance actually late in life. Started dancing when I was in college.
Oh, really?
As a young person, I was into sports and music. Well, music more than sports, but the right kinds of sports, I guess, that made it possible for me to make a transition into ballet.
Like, what are those sports?
Swimming, tennis, I didn't do gymnastics or anything like that, but I think it was just sort of like, you know, in ballet there's a look, and I was fortunate to be able to fit in, and I was tall, so I could be a partner to the girls on point.
Like me. Tall people like me.
But I started dancing, and what attracted me to dance when I started in college was the discipline that is just a part of a dancer's life, and that you're in the studio and you take class every day. And I was actually really inspired also by the music, the pianist in the corner, and creating this sort of every day going back to the beginning and warming up and working on your technique. And went to graduate school and got a master's degree in ballet teaching and choreography, and used that to actually get enough training to get into a ballet company. I danced in the Kansas City Ballet for 10 years. Before I came to Santa Fe.
Now, a ballet dancer's life, a male ballet dancer, is that the same thing by 30, 35, you got to figure out something else to do?
I think by the time I was 33, the other dancers in the company were calling me abuelo.
No, that's evil.
Yes, I agree. You know, kids would come in, they're 18 years old, they can sort of bend in half, they kick themselves in the head, they don't even know how they did it. It's like the sort of like the tricks that dancers can do. You see them on TV now where people jump up in the air and their legs fly apart or spin around 10 times. It was sort of getting harder and harder to think about keeping up. So,
and it's weird. I mean, I don't know about, it's harder to measure this with dance, but it seems like when you watch the Olympics and you watch the gymnasts, every 4 years they do more things than they did four years earlier. And the people who were on the women's gymnastics team in 1964 wouldn't even get into the trials now.
Right.
Is it the same in dance? Like the younger people just can do more things?
I think they can. Yeah, I think they can. I mean, one of the things that's interesting is that they're still studying the same technique, and then they're mastering it, and they have teachers that are helping them master it earlier and then taking it somewhere else. So, yeah.
What about you, Allegra?
Well, I started dancing at a much younger age, at wee four.
Girls kind of have to start earlier.
Yeah, it's really important because of the point work and the development of the body. It's really important to start younger if you want to take it into the classical direction, which is what I loved. And I come from a very small town in Texas, and so my parents thankfully, I saw that I needed to get out of that situation, and I went to a performing arts high school in Massachusetts. So left home when I was 13, had my first job at the Atlanta Ballet when I was 17. Met my husband there, Mark Morgan, the chiropractor here in town, and we moved to Canada. I danced there.
He's a dancer too.
He was a dancer. Yes. He retired. I kept dancing. We moved to Portland, Oregon. I danced with the Oregon Ballet Theater. And then at 30, just like Russell, it was like, you know, I just really can't get my leg up there anymore.
My back hurts.
Recovery time is a lot longer. I don't wake up the next morning and and ready to tackle it again. So it was time to move on, and we moved to Santa Fe, and Mark opened his practice. And I, just about pretty soon after we moved here, I got involved with NDI way back in 96, in the early beginnings of the, when it was really still a very small grassroots program. We were working out of Catherine Oppenheimer's apartment in Tsuki. And I worked with the organization for about 8 years, then stepped away when my children were really young. Had my own studio, Dance for Joy, for 7 years, and then I came back in August, and I kind of always knew I would. There was a part of me that really loves working with the diversity of demographic that I get to work with, and being able to offer the arts to students who might not get it otherwise. And
Do you feel that, or do you see that there is any movement toward maintaining the health of your feet and your body and all of that stuff, as opposed to just using them till they completely wear out in the dance world?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if I know the answer to that.
I mean, so many dancers who were just the A1 ballet dancers have lifelong problems because
Absolutely.
Of how hard they were pushed.
I think we all have our weak areas. Mine is my back, you know. I think that every dancer has a part of their body that's succumbs to injury. I think that the dance form itself has changed quite a bit. It is very athletic and has gotten very extreme. But female dancers, for instance, they're not always on point. They can be barefoot. They can be in soft ballet slippers rather than point shoes every single day.
So that helps.
It helps. Yes, I think dancers now, and I may be wrong. Jump in there, Russell. I think that dancers now, professional dancers now, have a little bit more understanding of their bodies. They cross train.
Yeah, they do things like Pilates.
Gyrotonic.
And that helps. That builds a kind of strength and flexibility that helps. And you see a lot of people who, after performing, after dancing, want to go into studying physical therapy or movement therapy or Pilates or that kind of thing, that sort of
alternative
builds strength and helps people really use their bodies in a healthy and in the best way.
And Lord knows you have the background to do that once you've had a dance career.
Absolutely. I think that's really, that's a huge advantage. If you're going to teach this, to have that kind of belly of experience, I think it really, you have the understanding and the knowledge to pass on. And I think that's so much what dance, that's what the arts are about, is really the passing on of this something that's maybe not written down, but it's innate, it's in your body, it's part of who you are. And I think that's something that we love to do. If we've done it and had that passion, it's that giving back.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, when you think about how many generations back people have been doing what the two of you learned, it's a kind of humbling and beautiful thing. Yeah. Well, Russell Baker and Allegra Lillard are with the National Dance Institute of New Mexico, NDI New Mexico. They are on the web at ndi-nm.org. And let's talk once again about the event coming up this weekend. It's Friday and Saturday at 7 o'clock, Sunday at 2 in the afternoon. It's called Winter Dance Escape, and it's the, what is it, the junior company and the...
Company Excel.
Excel, which is the high school students.
Yes, our advanced dancers.
And
choreography by a ballerina, a modern dancer, and a song and dance man.
Yes,
that's going to be
something. Martin.
Yeah, he's amazing. I love that you're using so many Santa Fe people for this.
It's really important to get that, to expose them to all of these wonderful, this wonderful talent we have here.
Exactly. Now we're going to do a little ticket giveaway.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh,
so how's this going to work?
If you call the NDI box office, which is 983-7661, we will offer you a ticket.
The first three people?
Yeah, first three people.
First
Absolutely.
Three people who call. Operators are standing by,
Absolutely.
We hope.
A pair of free tickets.
Yes, that'd be great.
But anyway, and give the number again for people who just want to call and reserve tickets.
983-7661.
Russell and Allegra, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.